Hey, my name's Ty, and you are about to listen to about an hour-long interview I had with a journalist student at Pikes Peak Community College. I want to thank you for taking the time to listen to this, and if you ever have any questions, please feel free to reach out to me via email. Thanks again, and enjoy the interview. So, what I've been focusing on is the meshing of different fields of industry. So, like,
yeah.
Artificial intelligence, machine learning, which is, like, a similar thing.
Yep.
Aerospace industries, economics, logistics, all that stuff.
Totally.
And the premise that I've built up is that through utilizing these technologies, we could actually build Colorado into probably, like, the nation's first largest aerospace
Yeah, I know. I was told you had an interest in that, and you went to the Questions with the Prez, I believe, and asked a little bit about, the aerospace department, like, what's going on in Colorado?
So the question I asked him was, like, if, as the president, what is he doing? What programs does the school have that are going to feed the growing aerospace industry?
Yeah.
And he gave me a pretty solid response. He was like, I'm sorry to say, you know, I don't really know. And so he talked about what the community campus is doing, what the statistics look like now. And I noticed that the data that I've, like, collected and recognized from the Denver Economic Company, they release yearly, like, things on all the industries.
What is that company?
It's the Denver Economic Research something. Let me pull that up real quick. But what they were saying is that we're the second largest in the nation, and that we, aerospace industry.
Interesting.
And that we have, say, 180 economic aerospace industries, and then 500 companies supporting that.
Yeah.
For a total of, like, 190,000 employees in the aerospace sector alone in Colorado.
Yeah. My roommate works, I believe, for, what is it, the Aerospace Corporation?
Yeah.
I think that's what it's called. It's got aerospace in the name. He switched jobs a couple times in the, recently. He's an electrical engineer and kind of just tries to go where the money is. That's at least somewhat interesting. But.
Well, so right here is actually a follow-up to the conversation I had with the president.
Okay.
Afterwards, he asked me if, you know, there was any... He came up to me, didn't ask me right off the bat. He said that he wasn't really too familiar with the aerospace industry.
Okay.
And that questions like that are the kind that make him want to go learn more. So what I told him is that, well, I've got this whole thing set up already. I know how we can turn Colorado into a quantum capable state, which only, like, at this point, the University of Southern California and the University Space Research Agency out of Maryland are the only two, like, academic agencies to have a quantum computer.
I thought they were working on, I guess they have a quantum clock up in CU Boulder.
Yeah.
But they don't have...
That would be different than quantum computing, which I'm prepared to go into if you're not familiar with.
A little bit, like I said, like, my roommate, we've known each other for half our lives, and he tries to explain complicated scientific concepts to me, which is awesome, but I'm not as physics minded and math minded as him. I'm more in the biology sector.
So that's what you were talking about when you said you were going to go back into sciences?
Yeah, totally. I was going to go into culinary arts, but I had a friend who's finishing up her master's thesis in glaciology, and she was sharing what she had with Taylor is his name.
Okay.
And he was just getting really excited. He wants to go back and get his PhD. That's what he really wants to do. He doesn't want to work. So I was like, dang, that was the most fun I had. Was like, I love biology, and I know philosophy isn't really a science technically, but I loved philosophy, and like, shit, I gotta go back that way.
Well, so I can relate. Like, I initially was going to major in psychology.
Yeah.
And I realized I was more into the philosophy of psychology, and then I took a whole different career path, coming full circle back here. But what this is right here is this is a letter to the president that I wrote.
Okay.
Basically outlining the data that Colorado has on the economic development of an aerospace program or further development.
Mm-hmm.
And I go in to talk about what it can kind of look like for the community college if, say, the community college were to be the one that was able to purchase the quantum computer. Go into the pros and cons of that, the different programs that we would have. And then I kind of talk here about the different quantum computers that are already in use around the world, China being the largest user of quantum computers.
Huh. Yeah. So you said, let's see, what University of Southern California.
Yes, and
the USRA. And the University Space Research Agency. Where's the USRA?
USRA, if I remember right, is out of Maryland. They're on the East Coast.
But so they're the only two universities or places
academic,
at all?
Academic facilities.
Okay, so there are facilities in the U.S. with quantum computing.
Yes.
Right?
So the way it works out, too, with those is, like, through government grants and stuff like that, they can continue their research. I know the University of Southern California's quantum laboratory was just recently gifted $15 million by the government on research into the environment.
Okay.
Like environmental causes, those effects.
Just in general, or
yeah, like CO2 emissions.
Okay. I thought quantum computing wasn't quite like achievable yet, or did we? Or
that's a great like question of 2018.
Is right.
Well, so in 2012, Jordy Rose of D-Wave out of Canada announced that they were going to release a 2,000 qubit quantum computer, which is the most capable in terms of processing power that we've developed yet.
Okay.
This didn't come out, I think, until about 2014, and the USC, University of Southern California, has one. So they're fully functional.
Really?
The trick is developing algorithms for them.
Oh, okay. So the computers exist, making them run is harder.
Yes. So we have the hardware.
Writing the code for it.
Yeah, we have the hardware, but the software is the part that's tricky to develop.
Interesting. Okay. So how long have you been at Pikes Peak?
I've been here this semester since the
start. This semester, okay. What's, is this your first semester in college, or did you go somewhere else?
No, so I previously went to the Conservatory of Recording Arts and Sciences.
Okay.
Which is a fancy name for a school that teaches you how to become an audio engineer.
Okay.
So I worked at a record label and in a recording studio.
Oh, that's cool. So do you play any instruments?
I produced music digitally.
Okay.
I use like a synthesizer and stuff like that.
That's cool.
Yeah.
So what... That's a little bit of a departure from music to physics.
Oddly enough, it's not as big of a gap as you would think.
Okay. I know there's a lot of math in music, and I know some famous musicians are well-known for their math skills and their physics. I think most notably, if I get this right, Robert Plant, I think, is a physicist.
Where's he from?
Led Zeppelin.
Oh, yeah. Shoot, I should have known that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I'm not too familiar with that. I know a small-time band named Taramellos. They're a band consisting entirely of mathematicians.
Okay.
Something called Math Rock.
Oh, yeah, I've heard of Math Rock.
Cool, yeah.
What are they called?
Taramellos.
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 One R. Mellos?
Yes.
Oh, I'm definitely going to look them up. I love music.
Yeah, it's cool to listen to, like, math. You know?
Yeah,
like, you know the guys that are making the music are using math. So.
That's cool. Then what made you want to change into physics and study that?
So it was kind of like a lifelong like thing. I grew up with a dad who was a Trekkie, and so like Star Trek was just a household thing.
Yep.
I was going to conventions, you know, seeing the dudes dressed up, all that, like at a very early age, like 5 or 6. And you know, just science fiction in general kind of like really gave me the imagery in my head, like, wow, we can build space colonies one day, maybe, you know, that's all cool. And the thing was, is when I was in college for audio engineering, one of our professors told us that if we ever get picked on by someone who's like another scientist, he said, that they would be like, oh, well, audio engineering, that's not rocket science, he said. Our response should be, you're right, it's particle physics. Now, at the time, I didn't really, like, grasp the full, you know, like, realm of particle physics, except for, like, wave theory and stuff like that, which relates to music. The propagation of sound waves through the air.
I suppose so.
Yeah.
I haven't personally made that connection in my brain, but I know they are connected.
Right. And see, I had to go to school where working with electronics and, like, you know, complex equations to realize that, because that all goes into the recording equipment. So I got out of school. I worked at a recording label. Worked as a contractor, just kind of like odd jobs here and there, and trying to work in the local music industry in Phoenix, where I'm from.
Okay.
And I decided to join the Army in
Okay.
So, served 4 years in the Army.
Oh, wow.
And when I got out, I thought to myself, like, what do I want to do?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, what do I want to see in the world? What do I need to do to make that happen? Mm-hmm. And will it positively affect other people? And so I thought really long and hard about this. You know, just getting out of the military, I didn't have much to do.
Right.
And I settled on space colonization. You know, Elon Musk has been talking about it lately. You got all these big shots, you know, at NASA. They released a hype video recently saying they're going back to the
right,
moon.
Right, yeah, yeah.
So, like, stuff like that. And what I realized this summer was, like, with Trump's announcement of the Space Force, I thought, if the government is going to be involved in an industry, then government money is also going to go into that industry. It happened with NASA in the 60s, you know, something like a quarter of the American budget was delegated to NASA.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that we're going to see that with the aerospace industry very soon.
Yeah, and, that would be cool.
Yeah, and that's kind of where I decided to jump in. It's like, if there's this new space boom coming, I really want to be a part of it.
Cool. That's really awesome, man.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's why I'm even more excited to read some of your papers now.
Totally.
I've heard you're a pretty good writer as well. Do you enjoy writing?
Yeah, I've always enjoyed writing. So
yeah.
We talked about music. I used to be in a band when I was in high school, and I wrote songs. So.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, I've always found that, like, the expression that you can get through writing is really helpful.
Yeah.
So, for instance, my English teacher, she asked us to write about something that we want changed so that we can send a letter to someone.
Hmm.
And so I was like, well, I think we should have artificial intelligence put into the city. And she's like, that's a great idea, but it's really broad. So she helped me narrow it down to, well, a project where we can get a quantum computer at Pikes Peak Community College or in Colorado Springs at large. And then from there, it's just exponential the amounts of things we can do with it. So that's kind of where I'm at right now.
Right, yeah.
With the help of my English teacher, I've gotten to this point where I'm trying to convince Colorado to buy a quantum computer.
That would, I mean... Who's your English teacher?
Emily Forend.
Oh, Emily Forend. Okay. Oh, yeah. She got Faculty of the Year last year, didn't she?
She did.
Nice. Good for her.
Deserved it, totally.
Yeah. I just talked to Keith Williams. He got Adjunct Faculty of the Year this year.
Okay.
He's a crazy hardworking firefighter, fire science tech.
Mm.
It's just like, you can see it in his face, but
yeah,
he's a cool guy. What was my next question? That's really cool. Do you think it would be, I mean, why would you focus on Pikes Peak Community College for the quantum commuting aspect when isn't CU Boulder kind of the leader in that in Colorado, or is it just location, or?
So to me right now, it's really like, who's the most important person in the building that I can talk to?
Okay,
and
yeah.
So from there, it's all
steps. Just go with your first step. Yeah. Okay.
So, I mean, if President Bolton is interested in talking to me more about this, you know, I'm going to give him the full layout as a scientist would to someone who's making decisions.
Right.
And I've really oriented it towards the community college, which has also helped me to kind of understand what it's capable of versus, say, sending it over to UCCS, right?
Yeah.
And so, with that being said, I can also come up with this plan to establish it in UCCS and Colorado Springs at large.
Yeah, that would be cool. I mean, there is a lot of science. Well, it seems like there's a lot of tech going around in the Springs, but still kind of small.
Well, so I'd like to kind of see there be more of a boom, because with the Air Force Academy, you got NORAD, you have all these really kind of like scientific endeavors. And granted, they're all federalized, but like outside of that, you have the Lockheed Martin, Boeing's, you have all the contracting communities. Mm-hmm. And then historically, you had Nikola Tesla had one of his labs up in the mountains. So it's like, you know, this is the perfect place, I think.
Yeah, no, I think it's awesome. Dang, that's a good view, too.
Yeah, I know, that's why I'm sitting up here.
I haven't been to the Rampart campus in a little bit.
Okay.
I went a couple years ago, but now I'm downtown. Now I'm moving to Centennial. Anyway, dang, that's really cool.
Thank you.
So, I want to talk more loosely, but I'm just trying to make sure. How old are you?
29.
Okay. 28.
Nice.
Little things.
Yeah.
Cisswood. Okay. So let's go back to you explaining complicated stuff to me.
All right. Cool. So basically how quantum computers work, I'm going to I'm going to do two things here.
Okay.
So I'm going to have one where I can draw, and the other where I'm going to show you the notes, all right?
Mm-hmm.
So quantum computers, at least currently the D-Wave one is the one that I'm focusing on.
D-Wave.
So this would be the ground, right?
Uh-huh.
And it's a big box. I don't know the exact dimensions, but you can definitely walk into it, and there's like enough room for people
to stand
in there. And so there's this housing mechanism, right, that drops down. And that housing mechanism is connected to computational, like, block servers that are attached outside.
Okay.
The reason that they're in a box, this box here is actually electromagnetically shielded.
Okay.
About 30 times what Earth emits in terms of, like, electromagnetic radiation. So none of that's going to get through. So then on the inside, the electronic signals that go through into the actual quantum computer go through this system of, like, wiring and refrigerators where they go about, was it 300 times colder than the coldness of space?
Because quantum computing, that's kind of one of the caveats, is it has to be super cold.
Yes. So what that does is, like, that slows down the atomic structure, so it's not spinning as much.
Okay.
And that allows for us to actually observe the, like, minutiae of atomic structures.
Okay, that makes sense.
So, at the very...
How close to zero Kelvin is that?
It goes down to, I think, 0.1 Kelvin.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
It's absurdly cold. At each phase right here, you have different temperatures. So I think at this one, it's like 7 Kelvin.
Uh-huh.
Goes down to like 0.5, 0.3.
Oh, wow. Interesting.
Yeah, I forget the temperature at which it operates at. But when it begins to operate right here at the base, so it's literally this big machine hanging from the ceiling, and at the very bottom is the chip that is the qubit.
Huh.
And so that's where all the microprocessing takes place, here at the coldest, like, portion of this refrigerator system, right? So at the subatomic particle, at the subatomic level, the laws of physics fundamentally change.
Right.
That's where you get the weirdness. Einstein called it spooky
action. Spooky actions that are just...
Yeah, but like things like superposition and entanglement are what the quantum computer uses.
Uh-huh.
And so you look at electron, a neutrino. Those are like subatomic particles that could be used as qubits, and are used as qubits.
Hmm.
And so what happens is when you go down to that level, the quantum mechanics of it start to really shine out. So what you'll see at the subatomic level is you'll have a particle, right? You have two particles, and they're connected. Their state is completely correlated. So say we change the polarity of this one to positive, then the one that it's entangled to will also become positive.
Right.
And you won't be able to, like...
It's at, like, any distance, right?
Yes,
no matter
yes.
how far apart they're... Well, we think, I guess.
So because of how qubits kind of fall out of the physical realm and go into the quantum realm, time and space don't necessarily exist the same down there.
Okay.
This is where it gets really weird. So because of that, that's how we're able to do that. The double slit experiment showed that when an electron is shot at a wall through the slit, so for instance, we'll do an example of that right here.
Mm-hmm.
So you shoot an electron here and here, and it'll correlate with the patterns of the holes, right? So you'll get little dots showing up there, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, the interesting thing was is that when we shot a wave through that, and you're probably familiar with this, but it's going into how the quantum computer works. You shoot a wave at this, what ends up happening is the waves begin to interact in a very weird way.
And so then you get these, the bands
creating
the wall.
An interference pattern.
Or on the material.
Yeah, exactly. And so what that really shows us is that until it's observed, it exists in a superposition, which means that it can be all at once.
So,
and
what was it? When we shot it one particle at a time, I forget. Oh, God.
It behaved normally.
It behaved normally, and then if we... But then, then what? They put something up, like, next to the slits?
to like monitor what was going on, and then at that point, that's when it changed into behaving as a wave, right?
So the wave, when observed, behaved like a particle. And so that when a particle is not observed, it exists in a state of probability, mm-hmm. being zero or one, might as well be both. But when they're observed, then they take form. And that's what the quantum computer does. So the analogy would be like a classical computer does things very linearly, right? Mm-hmm. It's almost like 1 + 1 = 2, 2 + 1 = 3. Mm-hmm. Well, the unique thing that this entanglement and superposition allows the qubit to do is to manifest all of those outcomes instantaneously at the same time. So it's almost like parallel processing to the like infinite degree, depending on how many qubits you have.
Mm-hmm.
Jordy Rose said that with 2 quantum bits, you're basically looking at like 8 possible points of output, right? And so then he said, if you get a quantum computer at 500 bits, qubits, mm-hmm. then you're looking at something like 2 to the 500th power. Yeah.
It's just a little bit.
Exactly. So the trick, though, is that, like, we probably won't have, like, quantum iPads or quantum iPhones.
Right.
Because they don't necessarily have the same applicability as, like, normal standardized bits or computers. But what they are good at are things that standard computers just cannot handle in terms of processing power. So, like, an example would be, like, databases. They can scour the entirety of a database and then ascertain all of the bits of data in that,
mm-hmm.
and then establish statistical metadata. So saying, like, all of these in row 9, section 7 are green, and that's also correlating to row 13 in section 2. And then it'll find what that correlation is and then present that to you. And so through the use of algorithms, you can come up with more complex outcomes that mean more to what you're looking to find. Does that make sense?
Not really.
Okay.
So I guess what is the main application of quantum computing? I can think AI is kind of a big one, because that's the biggest debate, to my knowledge, about like getting an actual artificially intelligent thing,
mm-hmm.
Is we don't have the processing power to do that. Other than that, though, what's the point of quantum computing?
What it allows for is massive amounts of information to be taken in,
mm-hmm.
and then for us to establish set parameters of what that information means. So it will allow us to, say, figure out the atomic structure of medicines and to better optimize those, because you have a set of outcomes, right? A huge potential set of outcomes. And what the quantum computer will do is minimize those to find the most efficient ones and output those.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay.
So that's just one aspect. And that can be, you know, overlaid into lots of things. Economics, for example. People kind of theorize that, like, if you get a quantum computer and you develop the right algorithm, you'll be able to crack the markets, you know.
It's almost like, have you read the Foundation series from Asimov?
I have not. Emily Foran recommended.
Oh, man, totally. Have you read anything from Asimov?
No, I'm familiar with, like, his...
Arthur C. Clarke, or...
Arthur C. Clarke, I have read.
Okay, sweet. Who's the third one? Because they're like the three powerhouses of sci-fi from the 20th century. Ray Bradbury,
Gene Roddenberry.
Gene Roddenberry?
Star Trek.
Oh, yeah. All right, fair enough.
Yeah.
It reminds me of the whole sort of... A main concept in the Foundation series is one of the characters develops a mathematical process called psychohistory. And it basically produces probabilities of the future. So it's not quite predicting the future, but it is like the
list of potential outcomes for the future.
But like based on probabilities, and they don't really explain it, because I think he's making it a point that like it's bigger than
what we understand
already, so he doesn't really actually go into it because it's kind of, it doesn't exist. But that's what it reminds me of a little
completely,
bit.
Completely, yeah. So, I would say the only thing is time, though. Mm-hmm. If you invest the amount of time to learn these concepts, you certainly can, like, get.
Yeah.
You know, otherwise, if you just walk up to someone and talk about quantum superposition, they're not going to know. More often than not.
Right, and yeah, that's why I love talking to, like, my roommate and just... Because, like, even one night we were drinking, and I was like, okay, what's the point of math? Like, seriously. I know it's important, but please tell me. And he, like, I have this big 26 by 32 inch, like, art pad. He's like, all right, this is how math is important.
Get a lecture.
And it made sense. It was pretty cool. So, yeah, I want to pursue math
that's
a little bit
wild
more.
Thing what I've learned with quantum mechanics is that, like, so there's this... group, it's a laboratory, it's called Quantum Research Group out of LA, and they're working on this new theory that would account for, like, consciousness, causality, a plethora of other things, but all relating to quantum mechanics. So they're kind of developing, like, a theory of everything, similar to, like, what Hawking tried to do, and they're putting out some really phenomenal concepts, one being that, like, the universe is built up of, like, physical yet informational pixels called tetrahedrons, and those make up the, like, building blocks of reality, and from there everything becomes what we know. And it's like, it's really just like huge.
I mean, that almost sounds like the same realm as simulation theory. I mean, if everything's made up of, like, pixels and bits of information, yeah. Like,
so I've realized that in the quantum community that there's certainly mathematically plausible, like, simulation theories.
Totally.
And this fits with it, and it kind of goes down into qubits. If you take the fundamental building block of reality and you allow it to be on or off or anything, and then you multiply that on a scale that it can create almost like a computer bit, the reality that we live in, then that kind of accounts for the computational sort of observations we can make of reality.
Uh-huh.
Why people think that reality is mathematically based or a simulation is because what we're learning at the quantum level is that reality exists in information.
Okay, yeah. Gosh, that's interesting. What did you say, the organization in LA, Quantum...
Quantum Research Lab.
Okay, yeah, it sounds familiar. Okay, I just wanted to look it up, because...
For sure. And I'll set you up with a link, man.
Yeah, that would be awesome.
They've done a couple documentaries, and then they have other videos where their physicists are talking about the mathematics.
Oh, cool. Okay. Have you seen the documentary? It's like... Oh, it's pretty cool. The Most Unknown?
No.
It's on Netflix. It's pretty cool. You were talking about, at the beginning, taking... like two groups of science, or two categories of science, and kind of connecting them.
Yes.
Maybe you said it a little bit more eloquently, but that's what that documentary kind of goes into. They take, like, a microbiologist, and she's at the top of her field, and they explain what she's studying, and then they take her into, like, physics world, and they explain, have, like, a physicist in Boulder studying quantum time, like, explain his concept, and they, it's. And so they do this with nine scientists in different fields. They talk to a psychologist studying consciousness. They talk to an animal behaviorist studying monkeys on, like, this remote island. Like, it's fascinating. And I'm glad I remember this because that's a personal interest of mine. There are a couple books that I recommend if you're into this kind of thing. One is called The Looking Glass Universe, and the other one is called... Science, Order, and Creativity. Both, let's see, Science, Order, and Creativity is by David F. Peet and David Bohm, and it's a conversation about how the categories of science, we've achieved so much in creating these specialized categories in science to really focus on these little parts of what's going on in the universe and what's going on in our reality, but it's become fragmented, and so we focus, you know, the physicists focus so much on physics and the biologist focuses so much on biology, when one could influence the other to achieve some, you know, great discovery, like,
right.
And that concept has always interested me.
Mm-hmm.
Personally, between like art and science, I love art. I'm an artist first, and I love creating, but I also love science, and it seems like these two are presented as separate concepts when creativity is such a huge part in science, and even in the history of science. I mean, I like the example of Albert Einstein because everyone knows who he is, but you know, he wouldn't have written what it was like, I forget what his like magic year was called, but he wrote his four most influential papers because he got this job that he finished what he had to do in like 2 hours, and then he daydreamed for the rest of the day and like thought about all this stuff and was able to come up with these concepts. So I like what you're doing there. Could you go more into what you were talking about? Because I don't quite remember, like, I don't think you really went into what you were talking about.
Exercise sciences and physics?
Yeah. So, okay. Like, pairings like that.
Well, so, everything that I've learned about quantum physics has been within the past 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
I've known some of the more classical physics concepts before, but this has all been based off of a decision that I made on space colonization.
Mm-hmm.
Space colonization is what I, end of game, want to see happen.
Okay.
I want to be... Are you familiar with an O'Neill cylinder?
Say that again?
O'Neill
cylinder? No,
yeah,
I'm not.
So... Let me show you this.
O-M-I-A-L?
O-N-E-I-L.
Oh, O'Neill's.
Yeah, I like the name.
Oh, O'Neill. It sounds super fancy.
So this just goes to show you like how far along we've been with space colonization for how long. This was an idea that, as far as I know, was perfected in the 60s. And what you have is a cylinder-like space station.
That's
right?
What that's called.
Yes. And inside of it, you have this. These are theorized to be able to hold up to 10 million. You can make it with the capacity of 1 million, and then through robotics you can enlarge it and expand the population. These, I learned, can be placed in our solar system at special points of gravitational pool. It's kind of like a gravitational anomaly called Lagrangian points, right? So here's Earth. Here's the sun, right?
Mm-hmm.
These L1 through 5 are Lagrangian points, where in our gravitational alignment with the sun, there are null points, where if we were to send something to L1 through 5, it would just stay at that place in space.
What?
In accordance to gravitation, you know? So it'll be here while the sun's still moving. These will all shift. And so...
But it'll still be held by the sun's gravitational pull. Why? I feel like that's a really...
So it's really just in how gravity works. I mean, if you look at it, so what you're seeing here is you have the Earth's pool, right,
mm-hmm.
on L1, and then the pools of L4 and 5 are what kind of project forward L2, right? So imagine these as moons that don't exist,
mm-hmm.
but if there was a moon there, it would be stable in its orbit. And then because of that relationship, on the opposite side of the sun, there's also a Lagrangian point called L3. So this is very complex space science, but this is something that I knew before going into this.
Yeah.
And so what I realized is that there are a lot of things that need to happen before space colonization.
Well, yeah.
But you have all these people like Elon Musk, like NASA, you know, a lot of the space-based people are starting to say,
yeah, there are.
We're going back, right? But I think in order to go back and to set up like a self-sustaining space colony,
uh-huh.
we're going to have to really establish like quantum computers, machine learning, which will eventually develop into
right.
AI, like automation, robotics.
Right.
All these things need to be matured in their respective fields in order to get us to space, at least in a sustainable manner.
Totally. It seems like with the technology and how fast it's being produced and how good it is right now, it's good, but not enough to do something like this. Like,
yes, so colonizing a Lagrangian point, we're definitely maybe 20 years away, I would say.
That soon?
I think so. I would certainly say so.
Oh, you mean by colonizing a Lagrangian point, you mean just putting something there?
Well, I mean putting something like Mir, or, I mean, if depending on how our automation goes in the next 20 years, we could also put one of those O'Neill cylinders there. So what you would imagine with the O'Neill cylinders, say that we get to that point technologically where we can manufacture them and then, you know, fill them with oxygen. Also another note is that the shape of it, they spin.
Right.
And that creates gravity.
Right.
So you don't need to worry
about it. I'm thinking of Cowboy Bebop, but...
Perfect example. Animes do a great job at explaining this stuff. Honestly.
Oh, do they?
Gundam, have you ever heard of that one?
I never watched it, but I had many Gundam nerd friends.
Yes, they go into some space colonization very hard.
Huh, really?
And that's actually where I initially learned about the O'Neill cylinder.
Oh, shit. Huh. I guess I shouldn't swear on record, but I didn't know Gundam went into that.
Yeah.
I know there was a two-season anime Netflix original called Knights of Cydonia that kind of... They don't have an O'Neill cylinder, I think.
I remember a space colony of some sort.
Yeah, they are...
Because I didn't watch it, I just saw trailers.
It's a good one.
The name always appealed to me.
What is it?
Mars, Knights of Cydonia?
Yeah.
Yeah, Cydonia is a place on Mars, so...
Oh, I just know it from the Muse song.
Which is another great song.
Oh, interesting. Wait, what? It's a place on...
Yeah, so there's a region of Mars called Cydonia.
Is it spelled C-Y-D?
I think if you Google it, it'll prop up with the correct one. It's either C-E or C-Y. Oh, it's C-Y.
Oh, it is. Okay, so it is spelled like...
Also, famously, where the face on Mars is.
Oh, there it is. And people say aliens don't exist.
Just proved it with Google.
Okay.
In the past 6 months alone, I have been finding every possible way that I can imagine that, like, advanced research and study and development would help with space colonization. And so, like, honestly, that's one of the main reasons I'm really content with starting this project here in Colorado Springs. Second largest infrastructure, 190,000 aerospace employees. Between the years 2014 and 17, we saw the continuous growth in the aerospace economics industry. 2017 was the largest growth since 2007 at 4.7%, if I recall right. So it's like, you know, we're getting to this point where we're going to have these potentials really soon. Not even just the potential for this, but we're going to have the material and the resources, but it's just not going to be utilized because the vision isn't complete. And that's what I'm trying to do, is come up with a complete vision. Mm-hmm. How can economics, logistics, the manipulation of matter through physics, mm-hmm. machine learning, how can these all be applied to space colonization?
Totally, yeah.
And as it turns out, well, technology right now is at, I think, the pinnacle to start.
Yeah, I guess I don't know. I'm not as educated in this as you, but I would agree. I mean, I wouldn't say we're at the pinnacle of technology. Well,
I think we're pretty close.
I don't know. I'm not saying we obviously come a long way. We have a lot of very, very good technology. I guess the hesitancy comes from, I think we get distracted with other technology, and we could be further in more important technology.
Yeah.
And this
is a great example.
Yeah.
I mean, this could probably do so much more than what its OS allows it,
mm-hmm.
but because its capacity is bottlenecked via its operating system. I mean,
right.
I'm only allowed to use what's presented to me in it. You know?
I think that's kind of affected by consumerism and money and,
yeah,
you know,
certainly
profit.
There's all those things
but
to worry about.
I guess that in a perfect world, we would be focusing purely on developing the technology to progress humanity in a good way, however you define good, I guess is the problem, because people define good in multiple ways, but yeah, okay.
That's also kind of the reason why I would like to see a quantum computer in the community college level.
Yeah.
Is because you're then taking something that only the smartest people in the country really have, like, usage of, mm-hmm. right? And so it's like, if your country has this capability, but only the smartest people are making decisions about it and how to use it, then is it really belong to the people? Who's in charge of it? And so I think by bringing this sort of technology down to the community college level, you'll see a more interest in STEM fields. You'll see more people who want to become aerospace engineers, who you can say in the fields of chemistry or medicine, could refine their studies through the quantum computer. So that's the magical part. It's like, I don't really think there's a limit to what fields can be meshed with this right now. And it's really all in terms of ingenuity.
Yeah. I feel like it's a good thing that the smartest people are making these decisions. I also think, I agree with you that it should be more in the hands of, I guess, the hoi polloi. We should be able to have their decision-making as well. But do you think, well, given things that have happened in the last 10 years, or let's say in the last 2 years, do you think it's a good idea to give that power to the people?
I think so. Yeah. I think it's extremely important because I think going forward into space, humanity is going to require a higher education of its spacefaring population.
Yeah.
So take, for instance, a colony on Mars. We're certainly going to send scientists there first, but ideally we'd love to have a general population that's growing there as well, leading to such things as like culture. But before that even, those people that are going to be there are going to be surrounded by technology 24/7. And the physics of our universe will suffocate them if they leave the shelter, right? Unlike here on Earth, where we're certainly more free.
Right.
So I think that bringing these cutting edge and really kind of like revolutionary scientific concepts down to the general public will also allow for just the next generation of scientists to be better at what they're doing.
Okay. Yeah, no, that makes sense. Because if we give these... it closes the gap between this like high level ethereal, like, wow, scientists and smart people are way up there, to, I guess, new students and budding scientists, I guess.
Anyone it'll help in that education really
and getting them to learn more and then being smarter as well.
Definitely.
I like that, yeah, and we should be educating more people. Maybe that's a good point.
I think in Colorado especially, I mean, it's like I've already illustrated, we have such a strong economy for it that, like, if we don't continue to grow a workforce for that economy, then it'll eventually go to more future-oriented states or, you know, areas. China is a good example. I think right now it's America and China are in the quantum race, so to speak. And China's really kind of beating us right now. Earlier this year, they released a quantum satellite. So they shot a satellite up into orbit, and what it does is it relays information from the quantum computer at the ground level, which was initially subjected to about a 30-kilometer transmission range. They've now boosted the signal so that it can go into orbit, and then it can send it down into other cities. That's a technology that we, at least in the public sector, don't really have.
Right. So they have the ability to write or to create algorithms enough for that to be functional?
Oh, yes.
And there are functional quantum computers in China and around our world.
So several cities in China, from what I've gathered, it's upwards of 6, maybe more, have quantum computers functioning in what you could say is maybe the core of their city. So, like, think of it as a brain, I guess. And what that's doing is that's calculating and coming up with metadata based off of actual data from, like, video recordings, online transactions, social media interactions, taking all of these components of metadata that the population of China is generating and inputting it into their quantum computers to come out with like spreadsheets of what that information means. So they're getting relevant statistical data on their populations, and then they're using that to communicate between cities on things like economics, logistics. So they've got a whole system set up. It's really fascinating, actually.
Wow, I had no idea.
Yeah.
This is really complicated stuff.
Oh, certainly. I mean, that's the cool thing. I assure you that I haven't experienced anything in quantum physics or my research into AI or space colonization that has been like above me in terms of learning. Mm. And so what that tells me is that really it's just the amount of time dedicated to learning the materials.
Well, and it's a pretty new field as well, so
it's so most research is going to be new research.
Right. So maybe the concepts behind it and the foundational learning is going to be complicated, but
definitely.
That whole, I mean, gosh, that's a whole new thing.
So I got a trick I'd like to illustrate for you, actually.
Cool,
it's a little hands-on, so we can kind of
sweet,
take it up. So I was talking to you earlier about qubits, right?
Yeah.
So a qubit being like a proton, neutrino, subatomic particles.
Uh-huh.
So there's an interesting thing called quantum spin.
Okay.
And what I just described to you as qubits, protons, those are called spinorial matter.
Spinorial matter.
Yes.
Okay.
So spin is a...
Yes, I know it's no, it's not Miyazaki. It's the
Hayao Miyazaki.
It is. I thought it was one of the other. I've seen that one.
He did the
Cat Returns.
And then Whisper of the Heart was Miyazaki.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Nice. Great. Cool. Nice stuff.
Ish.
So this is gonna illustrate in our physical dimension,
okay,
a four-dimensional concept, right? So think of this as like the top, the positive part of a subatomic particle, right?
Okay.
So positive phase up here, negative phase down here.
Okay.
So this allows it to function like a computer. It's on or it's off, right?
Okay.
Now, the weird thing with spin is that it kind of allows for this to be a state too. And this would be like the quantum superposition.
Mm-hmm.
So what's this? Well, this isn't positive and it's not negative.
Right. Somewhere in between.
Exactly. So the way that that works is that there's a 2-to-1 ratio in some subatomic particles, meaning that so one particle might spin 360 degrees, but another may require 720 degrees of rotation to go full circle. That's a very hard concept to grasp.
Yeah, because I remember sort of talking about the spin of a particle, but I don't really get that.
I'm gonna illustrate it using this bottle in my arm. So this right here, the apple or the coconut, is facing you. So that's the 0 point, right? Zero degrees. So if I were to rotate this all the way back, kind of gone 360.
Uh-huh.
But what we're going to do is not twist it and bend it. We're going to actually rotate this 360 degrees.
Okay.
And see if it comes back to the reset value.
Okay.
So the trick is to drink it too. So it's like I barely be able to do that, right?
Uh-huh.
So it doesn't really work.
Right.
So to illustrate spinorial matter, how it works.
So you're saying that your arm is the restrictive... Like something is restricting that 360.
Yeah, and so I'm not going to move my fingers. I'm going to keep it stationary.
Okay.
Right? So check it out. I'm going to do that and drink out of it, so it's going to complete its function.
Right.
720, and then I can drink, and it's my
and
arm's
it's
not contorted. It's back to its reset.
Oh, that's interesting. So.
So that's how these particles work. That's an illustration for it, at least.
So they're like seven... So you're saying the particles that we're using for the quantum computing have a 720-degree spin, and so that's why they work better, or...?
Like that. Well, so that's more... That's more how the fundamental particles work.
Okay.
They don't require that spin. They require that spin to function.
Right.
But that spin at 720 degrees is the equivalent of 360 for a normal particle.
Okay.
So what it shows is that something has to go in and on itself to come back.
Mm-hmm.
I want to show you an image that relates to this concept. It's a little hard to swallow, yeah, but I'll explain
cool.
it. So what this is you take a map, right, a 2D representation of America, or the world, and you take a circle from that, every point on that map, right? You draw it in there. What you come up
with. You mean like on the, what do you mean a circle?
Individual point. So take like a pixel, right?
Okay.
So then you just draw a circle into that in the dimensional realm. So it's going to go outside of the physical realm and come back into it. It's going to represent like a crystalline structure.
Okay.
A crystalline structure being.
This is kind of, is this the same? Vsauce did, I don't know if this is the same thing. If you take a point on every single location of a sphere.
And then remove the sphere?
Yeah, and then
you have a completely geometric representation. Because that's kind of what, like, so what I would say this is right here, right? So the reason this is called crystalline structure is because it's organized in a repeating manner. And so if you were to draw a sphere in here, circles around these, right? Not going through them, but around them.
Oh, around the points.
Yeah, then you'll see that's actually what connects this. And this is how you get geometric designs like that. So this is a video of that concept overlaid onto our planet because that's actually how particles work. This is a quantum physics representation of our world.
And this is this is it.
This is what happens when you drop
rotating. The Earth is rotating, but in a quantum representation of it.
Via the same method of quantum spin, which I tried to explain with the bottle.
Huh. Interesting.
Yeah. You can Google that at any time. Dude. Just Google Planet Hop. And it'll drop. But yeah, so that's a 2D representation of a 4D concept.
Which is hard.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing, too, is like I said earlier, it's like, with this stuff, there's really no easy way to communicate.
Mm-hmm.
Because these concepts exist outside of our understanding of dimensions.
Right. It's the classic example, I think, is a 2D world, like a flatlander trying to think of what a sphere is. Like, it's kind of impossible, but it's we can get close. I mean, obviously, with three dimensions, we have a little bit better chance,
I
think.
Have you seen Carl Sagan's video that he did on Flat World?
Probably. Some bunch of random shit like this. Yeah, he does explain it, doesn't he?
Yeah, so, like, I'll do it using this. So what he illustrates is that in Flat World, you have Mr. Flat's house, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Flat's house has a door and everything. We'll say, for the sake of this conversation, that my pick-up pack is Mr. Flat, happily living his life in, you know, two-dimensional flatland. Well, what happens when a three-dimensional object shows up? It leaves a two-dimensional representation.
Oh, right. So he sees the line.
Which is the point, right?
Right.
The point of connection in the two-dimension. So if I were to do this, it's going to be a different shape, similar, though. It won't pop up on the screen.
Right.
But then let's make it even weirder for Mr. Flat. Mr. Lighter shows up, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he just sees this weird, like, kind of ovular
shape.
Yeah,
he just
sees. Yeah, exactly. And he has no clue what that is. But Mr. Lighter can go in and out of this dimension because he exists as a three-dimensional thing.
Mm-hmm.
So say he just disappeared, left Flatland, and then he shows up, same thing, but now he's got this totally different representation. A little point, right?
Yeah.
And so that is ultimately what you get when you look at stuff like this. These are two-dimensional representation, higher-dimensional constructs.
Oh, wow, but then which part is that higher dimensional construct showing?
So mathematically we can figure that out. With a random image like this, it'd be really hard for me to extrapolate. So think of the idea of a shadow, right? Your shadow that you cast is just your outline. This shadow is only the outline. So if you were to be able to pull that on that z-axis out, creating a third dimension for it, you would have a new shape. You would have something that looks more akin to, like, what was it, like that.
Mm-hmm.
This actually right here that I've shown you, this is called the E8 lattice, and this has been, let's see if I can get a bigger picture for you there.
That's a cool picture. This is the anniversary of the shower. Oh.
So, if you're familiar with, like, sacred geometry, from Buddhism, from Eastern religions, you get stuff similar to this.
Mm-hmm.
Even, what is it, the Tree of Life?
That's what I was thinking,
Star of David. These are all geometric symbols that theoretically could represent higher dimensional concepts. So what this is that the quantum research group from LA that I told you about, they were cranking out some math one day, and they realized that in the eighth dimension, there exists this shape which encompasses all of our dimension. So what you're looking at is everything required to create this reality in this two-dimensional image. This represents the forces and the particles that exist in our reality.
In the same way that this line represents the pipe.
Exactly. So what you're looking at here is me and you 10 years ago, 100 years ago, the beginning of the universe, several thousand million years ago, whatever you want to say.
Mm-hmm.
So this is like what quantum mechanics has found is one of those things that's like, holy smokes, what are we looking at and what is the relevance of this? Yeah, like, how's this going to change our world? Well, for one, I mean, once we can understand the fabric of reality and why reality is, we can start on free energy, which will certainly boost another space race.
Yeah, but I feel like at that point, would we really be concerned with space race? Would we really be concerned? Like, I don't know. I think about that sometimes when I get to this point in conversation like this one.
It's I think it's in human nature to continue to explore, no matter what it is we're exploring. I mean,
that's true. I suppose. No, yeah. You're right. And I think that's always. Sometimes I feel like that explanation is a cop-out, but then if you look historically at humanity, that's kind of what we do. So to, like, stop doing that would be weird.
Well, I think the advent of quantum mechanics is kind of a symbol of the human spirit of journey, because if you look at the past, like you said, 100 years, we've ultimately mapped out every corner of the globe.
Yeah,
we still arguably don't really understand the oceans that well.
Right.
But we understand the surface that we can live on. And what have we done instead? We've begun looking so deep at the atom that we can see the things that make up, the components that make up an atom. And then we're getting to the point where we're understanding the structures that exist between dimensions. So I think this is a perfect example of, like, the human urge to basically wander. And I think that through this, we're going to continue to go to space.
I think that's, I hope that's the case.
Certainly.
We have some other qualities of being human that might prevent us from achieving that, but I hope that that doesn't happen.
The cool thing I found inspiration is that all the astronauts, when they came back, they all talked about how they had this sort of changed vision. Of,
like, I've heard that.
Like, you know, they looked at the Earth and they saw, like, how minuscule it was. Mm-hmm. As Carl Sagan put it, a pale blue dot in the darkness.
Pale blue dot, yep.
Yeah. And I think that, like, that there's this side of humanity that we haven't even begun to understand, because we haven't gone to the stars. And I think that once we go to the stars, it'll sort of give us a context to our existence in the world. And if we can, on top of that, figure out the fundamental building blocks of the world.
Well, gosh, I even think about, like, that's our interest in psychedelics as well. Because, I mean, that's kind of what we're doing when we do psychedelics, is we are getting our mind to that mindset of looking out, or being on the outside looking in, kind of like getting that bigger picture. But I can see why that would be a better